Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast about three men who are not at present on the moon, who review science fiction and or fantasy and or other audiobooks.
Well, the safer place is to be on Earth shipping stuff up.
Well, you know my views that this is actually the moon, and, you know, what we call the moon is actually the Earth, and that's how they faked the moon landings this entire time.
Where's the soundstage? That's
yes.
On the moon.
You're right. It does orbit us.
Exactly. So it all makes perfect sense. Kevin, what are we discussing this week?
Artemis by Andy Weir.
And who narrated it?
Rosario Dawson.
Excellent. Can you give us a reading from the back of the book, please?
Indeed. Jazz Bashara is a criminal. Well, sort of. Life on Artemis, the first and only city on the moon, is tough if you're not a rich tourist or an eccentric billionaire. So smuggling in the occasional harmless bit of contraband barely counts, right? Not when you've got debts to pay and your job as a porter barely covers the rent. Everything changes when Jazz sees the chance to commit the perfect crime with a reward too lucrative to turn down. But pulling off the impossible is just the start of her problems as she learns that she's stepped square into a conspiracy for control of Artemis itself, and that now her only chance at survival lies in a gambit even riskier than the first.
Okay, so what did everybody think? Barry?
I really liked it.
Excellent. Anything else?
I really liked it.
Great.
I also really like Rosario Dawson.
That's also true. Okay, Kevin, what did you have to say?
I enjoyed it. It was quite full of amusement.
Well, I'm glad we're getting this in-depth analysis up front here.
Well, you know, right up front, just throw myself under the bus. I didn't like it as much as I liked Martian.
How dare you not like it as much as you like one of your favorite books?
I know. It's a very difficult book to follow up on, I think.
So it's not your new favorite book?
No, it's not my new favorite book. But I still enjoyed it, and I suspect a lot of people will have an opinion kind of like that. Like, it's, hey, it's still a fun book, but it's not quite as awesome.
Yes, I think Kevin and I had a long discussion yesterday after lunch that people were not going to like this as much as The Martian and would therefore sort of review it a lot harsher than maybe they ought to.
Well, I think people's expectations, you know, it's really hard to follow something so awesome.
Right. Yes, after I finished reading this book, I actually went back and watched The Martian, the movie version, and it was sort of a whole Andy Weir day.
Next year, a special Andy Weir shrine. Well, here's my wax dummy of Andy Weir.
It's not
your
wax.
It's your Andy Weir.
I just
doll.
Pay him to sit there.
I'm not sure if that counts as a shrine. It's still creepy, but in a very different way. Anyway, no, I really liked it as well. And for me, it actually came a lot closer to how much I liked The Martian. I appreciated the fact that he's stretching himself a little bit rather than have sort of a, not exactly straight arrow, but, you know, smart problem-solving astronaut. You know, it's the same kind of character, but, you know, she's female and she's a thief and all kinds of other differences. It's a more heavily character-based kind of character. That was great.
Eloquence. Indeed. It's yes, our specialty.
It is. So I thought actually that it showed growth as a writer, and I think he should be congratulated for that. And so my review would be correspondingly higher.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only Andy Weir book I've actually read. Therefore,
but
it's the
did
best.
Did you like it better than The Martian?
Well, I've only seen the movie version of that, so.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was being sarcastic.
I wouldn't say that I've actually read it.
Because you
I
didn't
watch the movie.
I mean,
that's okay. I've read it enough times for you, Barry.
Oh, thanks.
In fact, I reread it over the weekend.
So I'm the only one that hasn't, you know, overdosed on Andy Weir.
Right. Indeed. Okay.
I mean, you know, we can go into a tiny bit about it without spoiling it as far as like it's about the moon that's on the back. So I guess that's fair game to talk about that it's on the moon. But I thought that it's interesting in that this is now kind of a new setting. You know, other books could take place in the same fictional setting, I guess.
Yes, the moon is a very complex fiction.
Well, just the fact that he's basically set up a city there, you know,
right,
and an economy and everything. And I think Andy Weir falls into sort of a kind of rare category now, which is, you know, near-term science-based science fiction, you know, kind of hard mm-hmm. science fiction, but kind of an optimistic, you know, kind of like on, you know, in the footsteps on the way to Star Trek, you know, start with Andy Weir and then like see where we get after that.
Non-dystopian speculative fiction.
Right.
Right. It's not like it's perfect, and they kind of, you know, they definitely show in the book that, you know, it's not perfect, but it's definitely optimistic. And I think part of what Andy Weir's doing, just to put words in his mouth, I guess, is kind of like, we already have the technology to do this or most of this stuff. You know, we could be doing it if we wanted to, ha ha ha, you know, or, you know, maybe that would be a good idea. Like, I'd kind of like to see more things like that, you know, from other people as well. And
well, right. So I think of it kind of as a slightly classic or slightly old fashioned in a way, old form of science fiction. In other words, it reminded me a lot of Heinlein, for example. There's this, one of his, for young adults audiences that he wrote, one of the Heinlein juveniles is called, The Menace from Earth, which is about a tour guide that lives on the moon and takes people around. And, you know, she's a lot like, I mean, she's a far more innocent version of Jazz in some ways. I don't know. This seemed in a way kind of similar to the golden age of science fiction and the science fiction of Heinlein.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of older science fiction, you know, they weren't going as far out into the galaxy or into the universe mm-hmm. as, you know, as you see books now, right, where we're, you know, traveling to, you know, very distant places to do things. You know, this is right here on our doorstep. It's the moon. It's like the next, you know, closest celestial body that we can get to.
Right.
So.
And aside from, say, Bob and the Bobiverse, then most of those are technically more like fantasy because these are the only things where we would know how to get there.
Right.
Within a human lifespan.
Well, it kind of reminded me of, there's this thing called like the Hieroglyph Project or something like that. Hieroglyph that, I don't remember everybody that was involved, but Neal Stephenson was one of the people that, and that, you know, people were sort of, you know, complaining about the fact at some conference or something that, you know, there wasn't really that much of the, you know, the optimistic science fiction like earlier. You know, in the 50s or the 40s or whatever. And like, and that, you know, a lot of scientists sort of, you know, became scientists because of that kind of stuff. And that now everything's dystopic and like, you know, destruction and horrible. And so it's like, it's not really, they're like, we need more optimistic stuff. So they did release, you know, a short story collection, which I read, and man, I don't know how they call that stuff optimistic. Like about two or three of them I thought were optimistic. And the rest of it was just like, I know, just made you want to shoot yourself in the head. It was just like, God, this is so depressing. Like, so I guess I misinterpreted optimistic or something. Or, but anyway, like, this would fall squarely into that, you know, category. So,
well, typically humans tend to ruin everything they get their hands on. So,
they're good at that.
Well, go with our strengths, I say.
Do what comes natural.
Okay, well then, so as our dome loses pressure, I think it's time for us to move on to our review section. We shall return, for we are sci-fi.
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 So, welcome back to our discussion section, where we shall spoil the end of this book until we all succumb to chloroform poisoning.
Damn.
And smoking cigars.
And smoking cigars. Yeah, that was one thing that sort of startled me. Maybe I don't understand about how flames work in an oxygen-rich environment, but she mentioned that he had cigars and a lighter, but I would assume that that would basically blow up in his face in a pure oxygen environment.
I don't think it was pure oxygen in the domes. I think it was just a slightly higher concentration.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood then.
Yeah, I can't remember. It might have been pretty high, but I thought what they said was it was a high oxygen environment of some kind, but that to compensate, it was a low pressure environment, Like it was only like 20% of like Earth normal pressure or something like that. And, or that seems weird, but I guess they said it's the same thing kind of like.
Okay. So maybe that's how it works. And that's why they were able to light up cigars without basically just saying, oh, please light your cigar from my flamethrower.
I'm actually kind of surprised they weren't smoking more weed, but.
Yeah. They didn't mention that for some reason. Maybe that's just considered legal.
Maybe that's what was actually in the cigars.
Exactly.
It was actually, you know, cigars, wink.
Yes. After that one scene, Tron Lanvik hands Jazz back a cigar and says, oh, here, smoke one. And she says, oh, I'll have it later. And she tucks it away. And I was so sure that that was going to come up later as, you know, she was going to get caught with it later on. Or this is all part while I was waiting for the shoe to drop.
Right. Or it would be like, oh, thank God I had this in my pocket. And this, you know, saves the day because I have something flammable with me or whatever.
Right. Exactly.
You know, I almost wonder if that was... Because that did happen in another Vanity Weir's book, kind of, and, you know, that he needed something flammable. And it's like, this is sort of like a, you know, something they put in there as a false, you know, thing to go, oh, nope, I'm not going to use it for that. But
sure.
I mean, obviously she was going to sell it, right?
Right. Yes. Now,
of course, that did happen later on with the metal bar.
Exactly.
Whoops. What do I have this jagged metal bar with me for in a space bubble?
Yeah, I saw that one coming a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So what did everybody think of Jazz as a character?
So I thought that Jazz was very well written.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I struggled a little with actually liking the character because she basically kind of agrees to, you know, not intentionally suffocate all the domes, but she ends up, you know, taking part in a plot to change the oxygen supplier to me, which is, sounds like a pretty horrible idea on its face.
I did like the description where she says, I'm sorry. No, this is just, this is not something I'm willing to do. You know, everything in her is telling
$1 million to do it.
And she's
okay.
Like, and she repeats that dialogue a few times of, you know, no, this is wrong. Wait, $1 million. Yes, it's fine.
But then in the end, right after she, you know, basically not covers up her mistake, but sort of, you know, helps recover from her, you know, tragic lack of foresight. You know, she's essentially rewarded by the dome administrator.
Well, she was going to get deported, but then she talked to her. That seemed a little unrealistic, but, you know.
I mean, I'm a little surprised that, like, the rest of the people in the dome didn't just, like, beat her to death, but.
Yeah, they kind of said, well, some people feel like that, but, you know, some people are like, hey, you know, how come we didn't have all this safety stuff in place? What the hell? Like, you know, you're just doing QA for the dome air supply.
I mean, but that's not the point, right? I mean, essentially everyone was knocked out by, you know, the accidental production of all the chloroform. And then, you know, she ran around and managed to flush it out in time before anybody died, which is a little surprising. But
yeah, I thought that part seemed like a little bit rosy of an outcome, but there was no other way you could really do it and have her stay there. I mean, if people had died, there's no way they would have said, well, okay, we'll just ignore that.
Like, well, you know. I did specially have it run past an anesthesiologist with a chemistry background.
Yes.
Who happened to be listening to it with me in the car. And she basically said that there weren't any, you know, anesthesiological or chemical howlers in there. It was actually all plausible. And the biggest problem with chloroform is eventually you get so relaxed you forget to breathe.
God, where can I get some chloroform?
I mean, even the fact that, you know, when she comes back into the dome and there's, you know, people who had sort of, you know, vomited and, you know, nobody actually managed to aspirate their own vomit.
It's because of the moon. They said the moon, you know, was the reason all that stuff didn't happen.
Everybody fell face first and avoided breaking their noses.
Yeah, because it's,
well,
you know,
it's 1/6 gravity, so they just sort of sink down lightly. They did point out several times that it's a great place to get collapsed drunk. Because if you just sort of fall over in one place, you just sort of gradually settle to the ground.
Well, they also did say it was also a great place for older couples to go and, you know, rekindle their marriages because having sex in low gravity was apparently amazing.
Uh-huh. Yes, well, let's see. I did confess to, you know, I guess we'll cover this in the Who Would I Be section, but I was sort of saying, you know, so everybody else in the entire dome is laid out. Would anybody else just have this moment of temptation of, couldn't they just sort of stay that way?
Wow.
Eventually someone would arrive from Earth. I suppose you can go out and vandalize the stuff and you're like, how long can I live here with everyone's food supplies? Like, you know, I could grow potatoes, let's just say, like, or something.
So, you know, maybe that's really the issue is, yeah, she does get some credit for bringing them back afterwards.
Well, they do go in several times about how she's, you know, she has, her character is fairly on the good side, except for the smuggling, which she considers to be not that, you know, bad, right?
Right. She's chaotic good.
Yeah. She's just sort of like, okay, I don't let guns and drugs in here. I don't, you know, I'm not going to kill these people just because it's inconvenient for me to like have to run back in and risk my life to, you know, get that Sanchez, you know, woman that was, well, I'm trying to remember what actually part she was. I mean, you know, was she the CEO? I mean, I know she's the one who started Sanchez Aluminum, but I don't remember now.
Well, I think she was listed
what her official title was.
I think she was listed as the owner of Sanchez Aluminum, but it was really being run by the
mob,
the Brazilian mob.
Yeah. Something like
Palacio
that.
Or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, anyway, it was, you know, she goes out of her way to make sure people don't get injured or killed as much as possible. So yes, but she is willing. She considers, you know, property damage to be sort of a victimless crime, I guess.
Right. On the moon. Yeah. You know, she's neutral good. And so she, you know, the only rule that she goes by is contracts. She will never break a contract. And I thought it was sort of an interesting ploy when the sort of lead marshal on the station, or I guess the only marshal,
Rudy,
when he says, okay, I'll pay you, you know, 100 slugs to tell me the truth. And she's like, oh, this is stupid. And she's like, he's just like, I totally knew you did it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was the main problem that I had with the book overall was that Jazz was not a particularly like likable character up front. It took a long time to kind of go, okay, I guess, you know, she has this code of conduct and stuff, but like, you know, it just seemed like, you know, from like, you weren't rooting for her from, you know, page one or whatever. You were just like, God, like,
well, and you spend a certain amount of time in flashbacks in her teenage years when she's by her own admission, kind of a horrible person.
Right. Right. So, you know, like I said, it kind of, you know, she kind of grows on you, but at the, you know, there's a lot of books where they go out of their way to make sure that you really like the main character.
Right.
And that was not the case here. So that took me a while to kind of get over that, you know, it's not really shock, but you're like, wait a minute, I'm not feeling this, like, you know, great desire to like root for the main character all the time. You know, I have to think a tiny bit. I don't like that.
Like, I don't like struggle.
Yeah. I think that's actually bravery on Andy Weir's part. He had the courage to say, okay, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to just assume that this character is sort of charismatic enough to carry over the fact that she's, you know, not the greatest person, as right. She actually admits, you know, when her dad says, you know, oh no, don't call her an asshole. She's like, it's okay, Dad. I am an asshole.
So she's a Ferengi named Quark.
More or less. I mean, yeah, she's totally capitalist. Yeah.
When it comes down to it, she'll do the right thing, but you know, she'd always rather opt to make more money out of the deal. And right. A contract is a contract is a contract.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that's a rule of acquisition.
Our word can
contract
be our bond.
Equal contract.
But only if you're a Ferengi.
Something like that, yes.
You know, in all of Andy Weir's books, you know, science is kind of like a major character in it. He's kind of like the background character behind everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, you know, science communication is sort of like the underlying thing behind like all the plot lines and everything in the books, I think, that he's written. And that's, you know, kind of, you know, in The Martian, it was like every page was just like, you know, this huge list of all of these things. And so I think he ran through 90% of, you know, his list of things in that book. And so, the Martian was sort of like, you know, this is kind of like space, you know, space travel a bit, stuff about, you know, colonizing other planets.
this is sort of like, you know, an ode to the moon or something, like, you know, how we can have a moon base and how you could do it, kind of.
Right.
And, you know, like some of the stuff that seems sort of obvious after reading the book, but it's like, oh yeah, Kenny could just say, we're having a spaceport now, everybody come. And it kind of seems like, oh, well, that's a good idea. Why don't they do that?
Yeah. I mean, there is a lot about, there's no lack of complexity in The Martian, but there is a certain lack of, say, economics. And that's where right. he's really getting into, okay, why would people be on the moon? How would they make money?
Right. And I thought it was interesting, too. I may be getting this wrong, but at one point they actually give a conversion from dollars to slugs,
mm-hmm.
where something like 1,000 slugs was like $600 or something like that. Maybe I got it the wrong way. But like.
Right. And slugs are legally not a currency, but they are basically the amount of grams that you can ship from Earth. And so they're easily transferable as currency.
Right. I mean, it just makes the math a lot easier to compute. Like if you want to, you know, ship 1 kilo of, you know, something up to the moon, right? It's going to cost you 1,000 slugs.
Right.
It's in-game currency.
And then, but I do wonder then if, okay, so at the end of the book, then Mars is experiencing this economic boom, but at the same time, there will be a lot more ships coming from Earth. Will the slug drop in value because it'll be a lot easier to get stuff up from Earth?
Actually, I think the destination doesn't matter because it's all spent on, you know, escaping Earth's gravity and then re-entering, you know, whatever destination is. It's the amount of time doesn't seem to matter because you don't need to consume more fuel there.
Right. I guess you can't get an economy of scale on rockets.
Damn you, empty space ruining everything.
Yes. Well, there were a few in-jokes that we mostly only noticed a little bit later, such as the Hartnell's Bar is, you know, we were all sort of like, oh, is that a Doctor Who reference or is there another thing? And then we finally realized, oh, the bartender is Billy. It's his bar. So that makes him Billy Hartnell, a.k.a. Yeah. William Hartnell, the first Doctor.
Yeah. So pretty sure it's not just a coincidence.
Yeah, exactly. But there were a few names where I couldn't immediately trace where it was from. So I'm assuming that those are all in jokes I didn't get.
Yeah, that's possible. Like Barry's favorite character, which was
Trigger, the cart. Yeah, the Lone Ranger's horse was named Trigger.
Rogers.
Roy Rogers. Yeah.
Okay, I looked that up after you said it, and I said, then said, "Oh, I'm not going to be a jerk and correct him," and then I just did.
Right, you waited till the most sensitive moment you possibly could,
and I'm leaving it in.
Good.
Yeah. Good.
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 We'll see what happens later.
Yeah, we will.
Good.
Good. Okay. Good. So I guess we're on to the usual questions, unless you wanted to talk about duct tape.
Well, that was, I believe, there was a nod to The Martian where, you know, Jazz says only an idiot uses duct tape as a pressure seal or, you know, depending on. It's like, yep, that was a whole scene in The Martian. Exactly. So that was kind of funny.
Anyway, on to the usual questions. Was there tea? Yes. Actually, they got bonus points for dissing coffee and praising tea.
Right. Coffee's just a bad kind of tea. Black tea's the only hot drink worth having.
Yes. Now, it would actually be harder to brew tea in such a low-pressure environment, and I'm happy that they appreciated that.
Right. They did say that they did mention that specifically about coffee. I think that, you know, people from Earth thought it tasted horrible because it was very like not heavily brewed or whatever.
Mm-hmm. All right. So which character would you want to be and who would you be? I'm going to guess that Barry is going to want to be Trigger, the cart.
Actually, that's not correct.
Oh, man. Okay. Who are you going to be?
I want to be Svobo.
Of course.
I mean, I want to be the guy that basically invents the better condom. I mean, can you imagine how much money I'm going to make off of this? I don't care about your fiber optic, you know, improvements. I am going to enable.
What I expected to happen, actually, was since it was becoming clear that he and Jazz were attracted to each other, I expected that he was going to get to test that condom, but that hadn't happened by the end of it.
Right.
Well, the testing doesn't happen until the second time, right?
Yeah. Was that a cut scene or what?
I don't think it happened.
This editor wasn't leave that part out.
I think I would probably, yeah, I think Svobo would be a good person to be.
I think he's also a good guy, right? I mean, yeah. he's a friend. He's a smart guy. You know, he seems like an all-around stand-up person and has a great idea.
Sounds good. All right. Let's see. Was there anything else we wanted to talk about?
I don't know. Who did you guys want to be?
Trigger.
Trigger.
Kevin wants to be the chloroform. Mm.
It affects everyone.
Is there a My Little Pony version of Trigger?
I really don't know, but I'm sure someone is in a lot of terrifying fanfic.
Actually, I would want to be her pen pal back home. I don't remember his name.
Oh, the one that helped to load all the contraband in?
Yes. He seemed to be doing pretty well by the end of it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think just being anybody that wasn't totally miserable on the moon would be pretty awesome. So, I mean, I said that, you know, the whole science thing is kind of funny because, you know, he mentions, oh, this stuff, and he talks about the Apollo moon landing and, you know, kind of details that are just background details in the book. But, you know, as far as I know, they're accurate.
Exactly.
So just little bits of, you know, science trivia where, you know, they talk about, well, how do you deal with heat in space? Yes, heat is usually the big problem with electronics and lots of things in space because you can only radiate the heat off. So it's like you have to have major, you know, systems just dealing with that, you know, as a large part of your design, not just like an incidental, like, oh, the air carries it away or whatever. And so like they talked about, you know, how she sabotaged the harvester machines or whatever they were that were mining the regolith for the aluminum ore. And so like they had like these big like wax wells or something like that, that would, you know, the state change of the wax to liquefy it, you know, it takes a huge amount of energy or something. And
by the way, if you are at all into welding, this will be a fantastic book for you.
This is
the first welding porn book I've ever seen.
Not only that, it's a family tradition.
Exactly. No, put on a second speed on.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, you're right that I made me kind of like, oh, maybe I should learn how to weld. That sounds like fun.
Yes. Oh, by the way. Yeah. We should have said this up front, but Rosario Dawson, I thought, did a fantastic job narrating.
Yeah. I think she just like nailed the character.
And there were just a few times where she would throw in sort of an extra laugh or something like that, that really sold the line just a little bit better. So you could tell that this wasn't just sort of like, I'm an actress. Why are you making me read this book? She was taking this seriously and doing a very good job on it.
Yeah.
That is the case.
That's correct.
But yeah, I guess probably the favorite scene was the chloroform scene at the end. And I think part of the reason was it was kind of like, it reminded me of some of my favorite parts from The Martian, where a lot of the stuff in here is, you know, science and kind of like, how would you do, it's like the heist book, right?
Right.
The chloroform scene was kind of like The Martian, where it's like, you're under the wire, you have to figure out how to fix something with just what's on hand, and you don't have like a pre-done plan, just like basically your wits, and you're like, oh God, try not to die. Like, you know?
Right, exactly.
Thankfully she had a sharp stick.
Yeah.
Although the thing that did kind of jump out at me when I reread the book was the fact that at the very beginning, there was sort of a throwaway line where they say, well, you know, we do have equipment there that will just recycle the CO2 into oxygen, but you know, it takes energy. So we just use the byproduct oxygen from the aluminum smelting. So I was like, if they stopped getting oxygen for that contract thing, that was the core of the book there, they wouldn't even have needed a secondary source of oxygen, really. They could just turn on their equipment, right?
Well, they didn't specify that they had that equipment, that it was possible.
Well, I thought that they said they had it, they just didn't use it. Maybe I
misunderstood. Oh, okay, maybe I misunderstood that.
But anyway, I think the point was, well, this would take energy, so why would we bother when we have so much oxygen, we don't know what to do with it?
Mm-hmm. I think my favorite scene was when she's out there sabotaging the first... The first harvester, and she gets caught,
right,
you know, on camera, and, you know, she realizes that they're coming out there to get her, And so she changes gears and basically starts to, you know, cause them to explode. And she's sitting there trying to set them off and then, you know, run for cover under the, under a piece of, sheet metal or something.
What was it? She said, okay, by removing the resistor, I'd created a machine called a wire.
Yeah. I really liked the descriptions of what was happening there. And, you know, after she blows up the second, harvester, and she's like, and then, huge, dents started appearing in my shield. And
yeah, no, it was sort of a Mythbusters moment.
Yeah. You know, in a lower gravity environment, things are coming down a lot faster than, or not a lot faster, but
they don't slow down
because it's not the low gravity. It's the no air resistance.
Right.
So,
right.
I thought that was a very fun.
We can demonstrate calculus much more easily. Like, yes, it's the same speed when it comes down as it was when it left.
The terminal velocity is the velocity it left at.
Yeah, no, I really liked, weirdly enough, I think it was a really vivid welding scene that when she was actually welding that stuff to the to the end of the manufacturing plant so she could sneak in. Yes, to the Sanchez Dome.
Wicking the metal into the gap.
Yes.
So you really weren't joking about the welding part. Well,
overstating the case, perhaps. At the time, it sort of went on a little long, but looking back on it, it was a very vivid description.
Yeah.
Is your wife going to be, wondering why you show up in like a welder's outfit at some point?
That'll stay between her and I, I'm sure. All right.
Lose the smock. The only way to end
this line of questioning is going to be to do a little chemical reaction over here and see if we can create chloroform. So until next time, we have been, I'm getting a little woozy. Sci-fi.